This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And I will strike down upon the great vengeance. I did not kill my wife, if you don't care. I believe I can fly, cause I'm the king of the world. From the 90s to nothing, I'll be there.
I already had intercourse with 8 men.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome back to another episode of 90 to Nothing right here only on the only place to be in your pop culture world. Yes, that's a lot of onlys in this intro already, but here we are, 90 to Nothing again. I am Russell Sellers here with my illustrious co-host, Mr. Sam Neely. What's up, Sam?
Oh, I'm only doing okay. There's another only, but that's only a few.
Just okay. Well, we're going to see if we can uplift your mood a little bit because the results of the poll are in. The people have voted. And the people chose The Wedding Singer over Groundhog Day, shockingly enough, since Groundhog Day.
This is two surprising results in a row.
It is. It's weird. I don't understand how it happened, although the vote was real close.
It was. And I'm going to go ahead and say I was one of those Wedding Singer votes, but because I expected it to go so heavily in Groundhog Day, I was trying to even it out a little.
Sure, and that's fair. I voted for.
But it didn't win by one. So
that's true. And just to say, I voted for Groundhog Day because I thought that might have been a little more appropriate for the season, since we are actually recording this on Groundhog Day.
That is true. And I did not even check if Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow this morning.
Punxsutawney Phil did not see his shadow this morning, so there will be an early spring.
Well, that's rare, actually. I generally watch the video.
Yeah, it was crazy that was the first thing I woke up to this morning was a headline. Punxsutawney Phil does not see a shadow. And I'm like, oh, well, that's cool. Early spring. And, of course, it's kind of a warm day here. But in any...
It is here, too.
In any event, we are going to talk about a true, I think, romantic comedy classic in Adam Sandler's The Wedding Singer.
Agreed.
This will probably make a lot of people a lot happier than our last episode, which definitely drew the ire of quite a few Place to Be Nation members.
We weren't even that mean to Can't Hardly Wait.
We really, I don't think we were either. I felt like we were being pretty fair there.
We gave it its due. It's just, it wasn't due all the accolades in the world.
I fully agree with you there. It is not that good a movie. It didn't hold up, but I will say,
listeners, we are kicking off this episode by pissing those of you off who were already pissed off in the last one.
Yeah, because you know what? Fuck them. and we're going to talk about a way better movie, I think, this time in Wedding Singer, because I watched this movie twice in preparation for this podcast, and I got to tell you, man, I love this movie more and more every time I watch it.
I do love this movie a lot, and here's a fun fact you may not know about me, because I didn't, like, I wasn't super pop culture when I was younger.
Yeah.
I didn't watch SNL. You know, I was in eighth grade when this came out. This was my first Adam Sandler experience, this movie. I had nothing, like, when you go back after watching Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore and all those, you can see the Sandlerisms, and especially after watching his SNL, but when you go into this movie without knowing who that is, it doesn't, like, none of the fact that it's Adam Sandler gets in the way of the movie.
That is true. Like, I wouldn't even be able to see this movie through that lens because, as I was growing up, I had watched, SNL and I had seen, Sandler's routine. I had listened to his comedy albums. And of course, I was a big fan of movies like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore.
Yeah.
So when this movie came out, to me, it felt like a real departure from anything he had done before. He wasn't going for the, like, I guess, skating that line between PG-13 and R, like, silly and offensive comedy that he was kind of known for. This was more like Sandler proving that he had range, that he could do something other than that, and create not just a good, fun, romantic comedy, but also, oddly enough, a period piece movie.
That's true. There's sort of this ongoing, I guess it's a meme, but not like an internet meme, just like a, you know, a social meme.
Yeah.
That most people hate all Adam Sandler movies, but with two exceptions, and everybody's got a different two. Now, obviously that's not true. There's a lot of people who love a lot more. There's a lot of people who hate all of them.
True.
But this is, you know, I would say there's three Adam Sandler movies I like. That are not even, there's three Adam Sandler movies that I think are a cut above. You know, I'll watch all of them, but this is definitely one of them.
Yeah, this, I think, I'm ready to stand by this. I'm going to call this Adam Sandler's best movie.
I will give you that. And I don't disagree. I don't necessarily agree, but yeah. I've never thought about it. So I'll chew on that and get back to you.
That's fair enough. But I feel like I can stand by that because I feel like he gives us almost a full range of his abilities here. Like going from, you know, the incredible sadness that he obviously feels from his character being left at the altar very near the beginning of the movie, to also just making like a lot of like really quick witted jokes and just being a genuinely nice and sweet, caring guy, which is something that I don't think we've ever seen Sandler do in a movie before.
But also being funny and not being a pushover, because usually like nice characters, like it's the way that I am about nice people in real life. Like I can't stand nice people because like yeah. there's just no personality there. But he's like a nice, he's like, it's almost like he's a kind person as opposed to a nice person.
That's
like,
a better word
for it. He genuinely cares about other people, but he's not about to get walked over.
Yeah, exactly. He's a guy.
And Julia Sullivan, played by Drew Barrymore, she's the same way. Her character is very sweet, but she is not going to take shit from anybody. Like, she straight up calls him an asshole.
Yeah, she definitely let him have. I think the only person that Julia has blinders on for is her terrible fiance, Glenn.
Yeah.
She kind of lets him get away with a lot of stuff that he should not be able to. And I think it's because, like most people who've been in real long-term relationships like that, that have slowly over time become abusive, she, you know, makes a lot of excuses for him because she doesn't yeah. want to believe it herself. But as this movie progresses, eventually she has to confront it that this dude is a picture of toxic masculinity, whereas somebody like Robbie Hart is kind of the picture of, I feel like, healthy masculinity.
I think so. And you get kind of the same, you know, obviously not the toxic masculinity side of it, but you do get the same, why are you with this person, with Robbie and Linda, yeah. played by Angela Featherstone, who is not in enough stuff. Like, seriously, I see her and I'm always like, oh, it's that actor, you know, kind of like with the dad from Home Alone.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, it's that person.
Yeah, she doesn't but, do a lot. She hasn't been yeah, she in really a ton does. Of movies.
She played the maid in the Seinfeld episode, The Maid. And this is just off the top of my head. I'm not looking this up. And then at the very end of Army of Darkness, she was the S-Mart employee that Bruce Campbell saves from a deadite in S-Mart and then makes out with.
That's crazy. She was also Jenny in Con Air. If anybody remembers that role, I mean, she plays a lot.
I don't remember Jenny.
Yeah, I'm not like placing that either, but she plays, she's been in a few movies, but always, really small roles. And much like the role she plays here, she's barely in this movie. She has, the part at the beginning, and then whenever she comes back a little bit later, when Robbie is, like, you know, trying to drink his feelings away.
Yeah.
But that's,
but you
it.
do see that, you see the idea that, you know, why are you with this person? But in both of those situations, because with Robbie and Linda, he mentions, you know, we grew up here, all of our friends are here. They grew up together.
Yes.
With Glenn and Julia, he makes the comment that she was with me before I made my money. They were together, and there's even a chance that he was less of an asshole before he became rich, and then he didn't want to give up the, you know, the rewards of his privilege and instead leaned into them.
Yeah, it's kind of the inverse of Robbie and Linda's relationship, where she mentions that she was in love with Robbie whenever he was in a band called Final Warning, where they're yeah. obviously playing, you know, a lot of the, I guess, the edgier 80s music, you know, probably more of a bar band kind of situation. And, you know, she really dug that because that's the world that she felt comfortable in. That's the world where, you know, she thrived, and then Robbie grew out of that and Linda didn't. So that's why I feel like their relationship, you know, falls apart, because Robbie wasn't willing to admit that Linda still wanted to be part of that world while he didn't.
Right. And also, Linda makes a really good point. You wanted to be married to somebody, you just didn't care to who.
Exactly. And that's one point. And she was absolutely right about that, about
absolutely.
Robbie.
Absolutely. And you know, I think that we have all been there before. So,
oh, sure.
Like, we have wanted to be married to somebody that was so bad we didn't care to who.
And
you know, luckily, I fell away from that and then found somebody that I wanted to be married to.
Yes, that was a much better situation. I feel like everybody kind of has to go through that, you know?
I think so, yeah.
And that's
especially, you know, when you're raised in a country where, you know, it's even more so then, where you're taught that this is what the idyllic family looks like.
It is.
And when you're 10 years old and you lose your parents, I can't even imagine what that's like. But that's a big part of why, of, you know, Robbie's backstory, why he wants the white picket fence life.
Yes, yeah, like they do a great job in this film of really establishing all of these characters, their motivations, and even with Linda, even though it's easy to write her off as someone terrible, she's still not, you know, blind to the situation. I think she made the right call there. She just should have done it sooner. And with her situation with Robbie, it's like she recognizes all of that, but even she has a moment of relapse where she starts to wonder, did I make the right decision? Was that the right call?
That is one thing I would like to see. It, like, I would like to have seen is, you know, why exactly she suddenly came back.
Yeah, there's not much explanation for that. She just kind of reappears, and yeah. I feel like that situation was really just she had a.
She's back because the plot requires it.
That exactly it. Because it gives you that one final push for both Robbie and Julia. I feel like it makes it like they have Linda to thank for making the whole situation very real for both of them.
Yes.
But one thing I do want to remark on about this movie that. It's only strange to me now. It wasn't back then, but this movie came out, as we said before, in 1998. The movie takes place in 1985.
Yeah. 13-year difference, and yeah. Now we're at a 21-year.
Yeah, it's a 13-year difference, but that would be like a movie being made in 2019 about 2006.
Yep.
So that's just kind of trippy.
When was Lady Bird made? Because that was made, what, 2 years ago? And that was about 2002. So it's kind of the same.
Yeah, it's like that, but it's like, man, how much did the world change between 1985 and 1998? A lot. And
I think pop culture in general was more about kind of putting each decade in a box.
Yes.
And so because it was the 90s and it was a movie about the 80s, they definitely... You know, I was even keeping a list of 80s things. It's like they just—it's like they had their 80s dartboard. They just threw a dart at it. It's like, okay, so in this scene, Holly's playing with a Rubik's cube. In this scene, Robbie's brother-in-law is watching the episode of Dallas where JR got shot.
And according to them, no one will ever solve the Rubik's cube.
Yeah,
that.
I'm pretty sure. I don't know this for a fact because I've never bought like a new one, but I think the Rubik's cube actually comes with instructions.
I'm reasonably sure it does. They also come pre-solved, so you have to mix it up and solve it yourself. So really, you could just open one up and say, huh, look what I did.
Look what I did.
Yeah. But the music of this movie, I think, is what really sells it.
Absolutely.
Because they steer heavy into all these like great 80s hits, and Adam Sandler proves himself a very like capable performer because he sings a lot of them.
Yes.
He is.
So I was actually keeping, a list of of the songs, and I was putting stars by the ones that Adam Sandler sang, stars by the original songs, and stars by the ones that other characters sang or that were also covers somehow.
Yeah.
And it is a long list.
It really is. Like when the original soundtrack came out, it was only 14 songs long, and it included
a lot more than that.
Oh, there is a ton more than 14 like strong 80s hits in this movie. That album was so popular, and demand was so high that a second soundtrack was released, and it was two disc, which was nuts. I don't know, that's just something that you don't see happen very often for any movie.
Didn't Forrest Gump do that, or was it always a two disc?
Forrest Gump was always a two disc. When they dropped that one, and that brings me to another funny joke in this movie that I absolutely love now, and it proves the timelessness of it. At one point, Julia's terrible fiance Glenn buys her a CD player and brings it to the house and says, it cost me like $700, and I'm just sitting here cackling to myself over that. But then Julia asks, hey, do you want to play a record on it? He's like, no, it plays CDs. So obviously she has no CDs. Right. And it's just, at the time that was funny because, we all used CDs at the time. We all had CD players. They didn't cost nearly $700, but that joke is even funnier now because nobody has a CD player anymore.
Mm-hmm. And we were actually talking like, so we watched the movie last night, my wife and I, and I said, and I was like, okay, cause you know, we have premium cable. So I was like, well, it's not, sure, it's on demand, but it wasn't, it was to rent. So I had to like pay $4. So I was like, you know, I could just put the DVD in because I do own this movie on DVD, but we don't have a DVD player, I realized. And the only console we have is Switch. And even my laptop now doesn't have any sort of CD drive. My newer laptop, I'd have to use the old one if I wanted to play a DVD on it. So,
well, I think you're kind of low-key telling me what I should have gotten you as a wedding gift.
Oh, no, we didn't register for that. I'm going to pick one up at some point. That's just, yeah, I got rid of my DVD player when I moved to Atlanta because I didn't, like, it was broken, and I was like, I'll just use my computer till I get another one. And then I started buying digital copies.
Now, I've kind of started moving towards the digital side of things too. Like, I actually own the DVD or even the Blu-ray of Wedding Singer, but I didn't want to dig it out. So I just purchased a cheap digital copy of it. And it's worth owning because I can watch this movie over and over again, think is a true testament to this movie's staying ability. Like, it is nostalgia for my 90s side, because, you know, growing up as a 90s kid, this was one of the staples of that decade. But it also plays on, you know, the decade in which I was born. I was born in the early 80s, and I get a lot of these little jokes. Even though I did not experience them in the same way that clearly a lot of the people who made this movie did.
It also shows in some ways how like weird some things about the 80s were. Like, there's a scene near the beginning after the wedding has gotten canceled when he's sitting there in his sister's house. And his nephews are running around, and one of his nephews is dressed up as Freddy Krueger.
Yes.
Because the idea that you market, like, you buy children's toys for R-rated movies and market them to kids was just normal in the 80s.
And in the early 90s, because I remember when Terminator 2, when that came out, it had I had the Fleer, I believe it was Fleer cards collection. I had a bunch of Terminator 2 action figures. It was big business, even though that was a hard R movie.
Oh, yeah, because I saw that movie when I was 10, and I did not expect it to be what it was, and I had nightmares for months. We'll have to do that movie, and I'll go over that whole story.
yes.
But I thought it was going to be okay to watch, because the only thing I knew of it was, oh, no, it's the Evil T-1000. Here, got you, John Connor. Oh, yeah, now we're safe. Buy all our play sets of toys.
Oh, man. You know what? They should have made an action figure set of Wedding Singer.
Oh, man, I'd have bought it.
I would have, too. But I think that, you know, we got the killer soundtrack, and that that this movie has spawned something else. This movie was made into a musical on Broadway.
It was. I believe that Stephen Lynch was the original Robbie Hart on Broadway.
Was he? Like, you will know far more about that than I will, because I only really just recently learned that this was also a Broadway musical.
It was. It only ran for a year, because it's already licensed to where local theater companies can do it, because they did one here not long ago. But there's some changes. I've not seen the show. I've heard the whole soundtrack. It is on Spotify. But some changes, though, that they did make to the story include Rosie, the old lady he's teaching singing to is actually his grandmother.
Huh.
Sammy, instead of being a limo driver, is in the band.
That is weird.
And when he goes to get a job in New York, that great scene with Kevin Nealon.
Yes.
Instead of it being Kevin Nealon, he actually goes to get a job working for Glenn, and he gets the job. And then when Glenn punches him in the mouth or whatever, he fires him too.
That is that's a few odd changes, but I could get on board with it.
It is interesting. But then the final one is that the finale scene doesn't take place in the airplane. It takes place on the streets of Vegas. And the script apparently calls for not just Billy Idol, but lookalike. You try to get lookalikes for all sorts of different 80s people. Like, Billy Idol's one of them. Tina Turner might be one. And then he actually shows up to the wedding chapel to stop them from being married by Ronald Reagan.
Man, this
little story.
The musical sounds incredibly nuts, and that is something that I would love to watch.
Oh yeah, I should have gone to see it when they were doing it in Atlanta. I just didn't.
Now, I was watching this movie with my girlfriend Elizabeth, and she said that she thought Drew Barrymore's look actually felt a little more 90s than 80s. I just kind of nodded along and said, okay, I guess so. What do you think about that?
I agree, because there's something about, and this actually bothered me in the 90s, about the 80s, that everyone's hair, male and female, seems too frizzy in the 80s. It's like Julia had a time traveler from the 90s deliver her some good conditioner or something, because she had much sleeker hair.
She had the what looks like what the Rachel haircut evolved into.
Kind of, yes. With the flip.
Yeah, that's what it kind of reminds me of, because you're right. Everybody else in this movie has like gigantic 80s hair in one form, fashion, or another. Even Robbie's clearly New Jersey gangster brother-in-law.
Yes.
Who's like,
who's that actor? I can't see him without thinking of him frozen solid, dead in Goodfellas, with Layla playing in the background. I looked it up last night and forgot it already.
I think it's Frank Severo.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
That sounds like he looks like he would be named Frank Severo.
Yeah. He is actually, you know, legit Italian. So that,
Well, because he's in Godfather 2.
Yes. There were a lot of big name actors in this movie, some of which who don't get, credited, surprisingly enough.
Yeah. Steve Buscemi is uncredited.
And he steals both of the scenes that he's in.
He does.
Is it technically three scenes? Because, you know, he's playing, he becomes a wedding singer and sings at, Robbie and Julia's wedding at the end, spoiler. Which I
don't
absolutely
think
loved.
Bothered with spoilers here.
Nah.
Oh yeah. By the way, in this romantic comedy, the male lead and female lead get together at the end.
Yes, like it's one of those movies, one of those rare happenings where the two leads actually do wind up together. Amazing. And you know, there is a scene though that, you know, says that their relationship may, you know, in one person's universe may be doomed.
Is that the scene in the photography studio?
Yes. When Faye the photographer is telling her, or telling Robbie and Julia before they're ever a couple, that she thinks they're going to last like Donald and Ivana, or Bert and Lonnie, and Woody and Mia. All couples who suffered either a bitter divorce or just bitter, ugly breakups.
Yes.
So that, of course, it was just done for the joke, but I don't think that's Robbie and Julia's fate. I think that they are genuinely nice people, while pretty much everyone listed on Faye's list there was really awful at one time or another, or in particular, still incredibly awful.
Hi, listeners. At this point in the podcast, one of our hosts chose to make a tasteless joke, which we've now cut. Thank you for understanding. Back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
We might edit that out. No, we won't. but this movie also did create a very famous and very popular GIF on the internet. Everybody has seen the John Lovitz curtain slide GIF. And of course, this movie is the one that gave us that, as John Lovitz is uncredited as Jimmy Moore, the other wedding singer that who's fronting a pretty good band, although his performance is really hammed up and
awesome. But he does give us one of the non-Adam Sandler covers up there singing Ladies Night.
He does, and it's my preferred version of that song.
Mine too,
the original version of that song is, you know, just what it is, but then when you see John Lovitz performing, you're like, you know what, I think I just gained an appreciation for Ladies Night.
Yes.
The crotch grab high note.
Sophisticated mama.
There it is.
That's going to clip the mic.
But that was good though. I think that's the song that you should have offered up to people. It might have gotten more votes.
It might have, yeah.
Remember that same?
Definitely. Let's just say if we had gotten the 35 votes or whatever I said, you know, it would have been Grow Old With You because I've known how to play that one for 20 years.
Well, and that's fair. That's a really great song. I'm glad you mentioned that because they tease that song throughout the movie.
The only times there's actually a score instead of just like a song.
Yeah, is that
the score turns into? Yeah, the theme turns into the Grow Old With You theme.
And the first time you hear it is when Julia is trying to demonstrate church tongue on Robbie.
In my notes, church tongue would be a great name for a band.
Yep. Also could be a very awkward porno.
Yeah.
You know, or
with a band.
With a band of the same name. Because, you know, wouldn't be a PTBN pop podcast if we weren't mentioning, you know, porn parodies of things. And I don't know if there
Is there a porn parody of the wedding singer?
You know, I don't know if there is, but maybe there should be.
I'm sure there is.
It seems like one of those that would be like, huh, I don't know if I should be aroused by this or if I should be like, oh, can you be both? Yeah, probably. It'd be a little weird, but maybe not too bad. But speaking of weird, how about that Boy George lookalike?
Yeah, it's Alexis Arquette.
Yes, Alexis Arquette plays George Stitzer. And the only song that that George does is "Do You Really Want to Hurt Me" by the Culture Club. And it leads to one of my favorite moments at the at the beginning of the movie when Robbie takes an extended break to help out this poor kid who's gotten really plastered. And
George just sings it twice.
Yeah, George has to go into it twice because Robbie's not back, and he's like, "What do I do? This is the only song I know."
Turn on George. Yeah.
You suck. Like that. Oh, that kills me every time. Yeah. Now
she passed away last year. Alexis
Arquette?
Or was she one of the 2016s?
I am not entirely sure. Maybe.
Okay.
Died September 11th, 2016, at age 47.
Because I remember. Yeah, the 2016 being the year of the celebrity deaths.
Yeah, okay.
Was one of them.
Well, now I feel bad about making a joke, but she was one of the celebrities we lost in 2016.
And I noticed that she has no dialogue in this movie.
No, other than singing. That's the only thing she does. And, you know, that's probably for the best. Like, she's there to serve you know, the sight gag,
right?
Which this movie does a pretty good job of, for the most part. There's only a couple of moments where I'm like, "Huh, that's a mite bit awkward." Like the kid at the bar mitzvah dancing with Julia when he puts his hands on her ass.
Yeah,
but then that becomes the running joke of the entire scene. Where
it does, and also that scene, and I sort of tell me if you break it down differently. I break it down as, first of all, when Julia and Robbie first meet, I love their first interaction because it's not a random meet cute and it's not a they hate each other because they secretly like each other. It's two people that genuinely like each other.
Yeah.
And they both are really nice to each other, but they also both joke around with each other. You can tell that, like, even if they don't end up together, they meet each other and they see in each other somebody they could be friends with.
Yeah,
so that's the first beat. The the bar mitzvah to me is when they first become attracted to each other, and then the kiss is when they actually fall in love.
Yeah, I think that is a good breakdown of how their relationship forms, and it's nice to see one form in a healthier fashion, because you know, you called out the cliches of all the typical romantic comedies that we see. You know, couple hates each other at first, then winds up getting together because they secretly did like each other all along.
Right.
But in this, it's like, no, these are two people who could genuinely be friends. And if their respective relationships had actually worked out, it's very,
they still would have been friends.
Yeah, they still would have been friends. It's unlikely that any romantic interest would have ever formed.
Yeah.
So it's kind of refreshing to see that, you know, the filmmakers, the writers of this movie were willing to go there and try something different. And the writers on this movie, of course, Sandler is a writer on the film, but this movie also includes uncredited writers, Judd Apatow and Carrie Fisher.
I did not know that on either side.
Yes, that's one of those things that Carrie Fisher was known to have worked on a lot of scripts in Hollywood that she didn't get any credit for.
Wow. And that sucks.
Yeah. It was the, you know, the shitty way that Hollywood was back in the day, and probably still is, in a lot of ways.
Sure.
A lot of really talented, especially female writers, not getting any credit for the movies that they contributed to. But, when I'm watching this movie and I think back on some of the comedies that, that Carrie Fisher was actually in on, I can start to, it has that tone that I feel like would be associated with her. Like it feels like a movie she contributed to. So, I think people have seen,
so I'm thinking her. Harry Met Sally. Did she help write that one, or was she just in it?
I think she probably did help write that one. I think that was one of the earlier films that she contributed to that people started to really say, hey, wait a minute, this girl's got a lot of talent in the writing room. We should consult her on all of our scripts.
Okay. And then the other one that I was thinking of that I saw her in, that she played a small part in, was Heartbreakers.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen that since high school. So.
But when you think about both of those films and then you look at Wedding Singer, it's like, well, there is kind of a common thread here in tone.
There is definitely kind of this clever, and the characters are, this is something that I noticed really for the first time last night, that there are some parts where the dialogue is really wordy and it seems to be a little stuffed with exposition.
Yeah.
But the actors really sell it. And, well, for the most part, but, what I want to say is I think the actor who sells it best is Christine Taylor as Holly Sullivan. If you listen to the words she's saying, she was given some awkward lines to say, because it's like they're trying to make her this one kind of character, but they're also trying to make her try to get Julia and Robbie together at some point, but then they're also trying to make her give a bunch of backstory and exposition, and they just sort of threw all that at her, and she handles it perfectly. She makes the most awkward lines sound the most natural.
She really does.
Like, I've never thought of Christine Taylor as someone with acting chops. She's mainly just like a comedy person, because I just see her in comedies.
Yeah. Like she, and of course, otherwise known as Ben Stiller's actual wife, as the love interest, yes, in Zoolander. And she's actually really great in this movie. You're absolutely right on that. Her delivery of those lines is something that helps to elevate them. And as I said, I was watching this with Elizabeth the other night, and she called out that Christine's lines are pretty terrible. Like, especially after the kiss with Robbie, when she looks at him and says, yummy. She rolled her eyes hard at that. She was like, you know what? That was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Like who asked her to actually say that? That whole scene with Robbie's pretty awkward.
Oh, it is. And the whole trope of you not knowing how to write a sexually forward woman without making her the butt of the joke in some way, like, that really did not age well. But also, she still made it work. Like, she still made that character work.
She absolutely.
But my favorite Robbie awkwardness, that entire double date scene, he is just, like, stiff in the chair. Everyone else is relaxed. And he's just so outside his element. I mean, he lives in his sister's basement. His address has a one half at the end of it because he lives in the basement. He doesn't hang out at clubs like that.
No,
we've all been in that situation before. We've all been just stiff in the chair, like,
yeah,
he keeping an eye on the exits.
Like, he knows Christine and he knows Julia, but he doesn't really know Glenn. Doesn't really think much of him by that point, I don't think. And that whole scene is just so not him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really Julia either. She's having to get like plastered in order to just, you know, get through the night. I think by a combination of this is not her scene and she doesn't like seeing Robbie out with Christine.
Yeah.
So she's trying to drink all of this away. And,
yeah. And then of course Glenn, like the whole Glenn thing, that's another one that to me seems kind of unnatural. Like, if you're someone who is constantly unfaithful and you're out with someone that you're pretty sure is into your significant other, you're not going to turn around and brag to that person.
Like, no.
If anything, you're going to make up that you're doing that and brag to that person just to fuck with them and see if they turn around and say something. Like, that's... If anything.
Yeah. So that scene is probably like, I mean, and purposefully so, it's meant to be, you know, painfully awkward for Robbie, and we're meant to feel that and to feel kind of his, his righteous indignation whenever, Glenn reveals all of his cheating ways, which were probably kind of obvious before that, but it's, you know, they had to verbalize it to make it real.
Yeah, and we're meant to, at that point, you know, we need a reason to hate Glenn. Up until then, it's just, oh, well, he's a jerk. Oh, yeah, he's got more money. Yeah, all this other stuff. But at that, we need a reason to actually, like, say, oh, this is a bad guy. And so they had to kind of get that to us there.
Oh, absolutely. He's already the villain of the story. You can kind of tell that. But, but that firmly establishes him as an irredeemable asshole.
But it's also a scene where a badly written line, like his whole little monologue about why he's marrying Julia and how he's such a cheater is really like poorly written. But that's another, and I don't actually know the actor's name off the top of my head. But he sells a bad line really well, the same way that Christine Taylor did with some of Holly's bad lines.
Yeah, it was Matthew Glaive played him.
Matthew Glaive. The only thing I can think of him in was The Forgotten with Julianne Moore.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that movie.
There you go.
It was there. I took it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he sells the lines really well. He is a completely believable prick.
Oh, yeah.
But... As you pointed out a couple of times, that some of the dialogue in this movie is not written very well, and it's all on the strength of the cast to deliver it in a way that makes it palatable for the audience. And I don't think anybody fails to do that in this movie. Like, everyone really hits their marks, and Matthew Glaive as Glenn for sure does that, because if there's any one part of this movie that is wholly unbelievable other than all of it, it would be that part in the bar at the club where he's revealing all of this information to Robbie, who is to him a perfect stranger and is friends with his fiance. So it's like, why are you telling him all this? You're not even that drunk. Like, you've drank a little bit, but not to the point where you're just going to like spill your guts to a perfect stranger. That's probably the most unbelievable thing that happens to me, is that he's just going to drop all of this right there to Robbie, and Robbie could run back to Julia right now and be like, hey, guess what this guy's been doing?
Mm-hmm.
So that seems a little out there, unless Glenn is, you know, so arrogant that he believes he can keep Robbie's mouth shut. But,
yeah, I don't know. Like, there's not a lot of, and that's like, the most, like, I honestly, the thing that would fix these little, because these are nitpicks. These are not,
they really are.
This movie. Yeah. They don't detract from the enjoyment of the movie. But the thing that would even take those away, maybe the script could have had one more rewrite.
Yeah, I think that's,
I'm pretending that I know anything about the industry, which I don't, But to me, that sounds like a reasonable solution.
It's a minor thing. It really is, especially since this movie is one of those that's, you know, just all about having like a good fun. This is like maybe my favorite date movie ever.
Like, okay. I didn't see it on a date.
No, I'm just thinking like if you're thinking of a date night, like a good date night, like you and your significant other, or maybe it's the first time you're having your new flame over for a movie night. This is a perfect film to put on because it's just so well balanced.
Yeah, I mean it's got something for everyone.
It really does. Like all the jokes land. I can't think of one that doesn't work for me. I was laughing at all the times I feel like the filmmakers intended me to. You know, it's just that's what you want in a good rom-com, one that I feel like guys and girls can all agree on this movie.
Yeah.
There is something that we should mention before we go, because this movie has a lot of ancillary characters. People on the outskirts who are doing funny things, stuff that kind of sticks with you, even if you don't remember the name of the character. They're so minor in their supporting role that you remember them specifically for just the funny joke. Now, do you have a favorite among them?
Among all the characters, or just among like the ancillaries?
Yeah, like your favorite ancillary character in this movie.
Rose.
Rosie is absolutely it. The discussion about the first time she had sex, and then how many men she had sex with back in the day.
And that would be like 18. It would be like 200 today.
She's like, I had already had sex with 8 men by the time I got married. Yeah. It'd be like 200 today. I'm like, wow.
And I love also, and this is definitely not intended by the writers, and it's just a real deep pull on my part, but the song that he's teaching her to sing is Till There Was You from The Music Man.
Yes.
The Music Man, the whole, like, in that story, because I don't know if you know the story, but the whole thing is that he's a con artist pretending to be a band instructor.
Yep.
He meets this girl, and he's not that into her until he starts singing this song with his buddy about how he wants the sadder but wiser girl, basically saying he wants someone who's got a history, so she'll put out. And then he finds out that this girl has a history, or is rumored to have a history, and then he's interested in her. And that's like kind of, it's very below the surface, because the film of The Music Man came out in the 60s, and they actually had to add in a little explainer for that. But the fact that she sings the song sung by that woman character, after having already established that she's like, well, I had sex with 1985, 200 men. Just to me, that was kind of a little fun nod, but it's also probably not intended, just something I came up with.
It could have been intended, though. This movie is done by apparently like really intelligent people who are, you know, very well cultured, I think. So it very well could have been intentional. And I also just have this thing about loving seeing elderly people perform hip hop. So seeing Rosie at the end of the movie, or near the end of the movie, performing Rapper's Delight is just one of my favorite little gags in any Sandler film. So Rosie is a clear favorite.
She also gets one of my favorite rom-com lines right near the end when Robbie says, I got to go take care of something. And she says, I know you do. Go get her.
Yeah, it's like she's...
She knows. Yeah. Like, you see the scenes of her kind of realizing what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. Like, she is the wise sage old lady who also has like really uncomfortable but yet just so freaking funny lines. She is played by Ellen Albertini Dow, and she's been in she's had a long movie career. Like, she's been in Hollywood forever before she passed away. But Rosie might be my favorite of her roles, but she was also great in Patch Adams, which is one of my other favorite 90s films that hopefully we'll get to later on.
We will need to, because I've actually not watched it.
It is another tremendous film. And of course, I think other than Rosie, which we knew was kind of, which I kind of figured was probably going to be both of our favorites.
Yeah.
I think for me, right behind that is David Veltri, played by the uncredited Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
Because he He's great. And then, of course, Jimmy Moore, played by John Lovitz, who was also, oddly enough, uncredited in this film.
Yes.
And Brian Posehn is in this. Uncredited. He's one of the freaks at Table 9. But he
had, I saw him. And I don't ever know his name. He's just, you see him, he's very recognizable.
Yeah, he's in there. And then, of course, we talked about, you mentioned Kevin Nealon is in the film.
He was uncredited, right?
No, he's actually credited in the film.
He is credited, okay.
Yes, he plays Mr. Sims at the bank, where Robbie is, as you correctly pointed out, one of the funny, one of the low-key funniest scenes in the movie.
Yes.
I felt like that was, you know, a nice thing of Sandler to keep putting Kevin Nealon in his movies, because he appears in several of them. So, but those are the... I think those are the ancillary characters who really stand out, at least for me.
So I do want to throw a couple out, because the old man at the bar.
Oh yes, yes.
Also, Sammy, who is the epitome of a tryhard.
Oh yeah,
And it's like he's playing it as though he thinks that he's Fonzie, but he's not Fonzie.
He has a great line in the bar when Robbie is at his lowest point and saying that he wants to be like Sammy and just have a different girl every night and be happy. And Sammy,
says I'm not happy.
Yeah, Sammy reveals to him that he's not happy. He's miserable because he's like, you think about what happened to Fonzie, and I forget the other character that he mentioned.
Finny Barbarino?
Yeah, Finny Barbarino. He says, you know, what happened to those guys? And he said, their shows got canceled because nobody wants to see a 50-year-old dude hitting on chicks.
Yeah. The other thing is, there's a lot of television shows where they'll have a character whose whole persona is that they're out to get laid, and then later, when the show keeps going on, they try to humanize that character, but at no point do they ever change. This doesn't do that. This actually has to have Sammy admit that he's lonely, and that he wants to change, and that he wants to settle down.
And then,
next day, him and Holly kind of have a connection.
Yes, which was great. And it's like, okay, they're having Sammy admit this, and that all he really wants is for someone to hold him and to tell him it's going to be all right. Enter our favorite drunk old man.
Everything's going to be all right.
And then when Robbie leaves and comes back, and the old man, I didn't notice till last night that the man is now wearing the Michael Jackson jacket.
Yes.
And he's teaching, and Sammy's trying to teach him how to moonwalk.
Which was I think that was the moment where they really telegraphed to you that Sammy just grew up.
Yeah.
Because Sammy is now spending his evening with this old guy and trying to help him have a good time.
Yep. And he passed on the mantle.
Yeah, he passed the Michael Jackson jacket to him, which was, I guess we should call it the Thriller jacket, because that's what it was.
Yeah.
And that was awesome of him. Love the character arc for Sammy. He is played by Alan Covert. Yes.
Covert, yeah. Because he's in all the Sandler movies.
Yes, yes. He also makes appearances in pretty much every Adam Sandler film, all the Happy Madison productions. He's a big part of that team. He is genuinely hilarious in this movie. Absolutely love the character of Sammy. And that old man also gets one of my another of my favorite lines of any comedy, when he steps in and punches Glenn in the face as hard as he can, but Glenn just like totally no-sells it. Like, he doesn't barely move. It's like he just kind of brushes him.
Yeah.
And Robbie looks over and is like, man, what are you doing, man? He's like, I'm sorry. I used to be a lot stronger. Oh my God. This movie is a classic. Everybody needs to go and watch this. Watch it multiple times. And if you're like me, the ending will still get you to choke up. I watched it twice, and I'm still like, I find myself just moved by the end of the film when Robbie finally performs the song, the new song he's written for Julia, Grow Old With You.
Using Billy Idol's guitar.
Which was great, by the way. Yes. And how funny is it that
they had to explain how a guitar got on the plane, so they put Billy Idol in the movie.
Yes, it's like they put Billy Idol for real in the movie. How great is it that somebody's reading a copy of Rolling Stone from 85 that has Billy Idol on the cover, and then they have legit Billy Idol in the film, but it's 1998 Billy Idol,
yes.
who looks real rough.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you see the picture of Billy Idol in 85. You even saw the video for White Wedding.
Yeah, you saw the video for White Wedding at the beginning.
And
but, there's plenty of anachronisms. Like, Julia and Glenn's wedding was supposed to be on Sunday, August 5th, 1985, which was a Monday.
Oops. In an alternate universe, Sam. An alternate universe, that's the calendar is different.
In the Berenstain Bears universe.
You know what? I'm good with it. let's bring about some talking bears. That would be fun.
That's right. But also, okay, so I have so many random little notes that I thought were cool. In the Love Stinks scene, there's a guy, a blonde-haired guy, sitting next to Sideburn Lady. It looks like Jake Busey. I don't think it is, but it looks like him.
It might have been.
Yeah, but also Sammy's limo, he has a vanity tag on the front that says, "I'm kinky."
Yes, he does. That's awesome.
I never noticed that before.
That was really good, though.
Music in general. I think in terms of the songs, like, because there's, oh, I don't even, like, we're, it's like, we almost need a separate episode just to talk about the music.
There is one other thing. Like, some of the cast in this movie was not the original cast for the film.
Okay, so you got that in. Well, let's hear it.
Glenn Gulia was not originally going to be played by Matthew Glaive. He was originally going to be played by Jim Carrey.
That would not have been as good.
No, the role was actually written for Jim Carrey. He was offered and he declined. And if he had accepted the role, this would be the only time he and Adam Sandler would co-star in a movie together, of course. Because they've never done a movie together before or since. And that's really the main one that I think. Everybody else, I think, pretty much accepted their roles or were going to play, or these characters were intended to be played by these people.
Right.
But Matthew Glaive was probably the one they added at the last minute because they couldn't get Jim Carrey.
I just think that works better. Like, there's such a contrast between the two characters, between Glenn and Robbie, that I don't think would be there, even with Jim Carrey at his peak acting performance. That contrast wouldn't be there.
Yeah, it works better this way, because Jim Carrey is such an animated actor whenever he's in a comedy that I don't know that it would have... His type of performance would not have fit Glenn.
Yeah.
I feel like
Glenn... Also, his voice is too high.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's too thin. Like, just a bunch of little things.
Yeah, it's little stuff. But, I mean, the real star of this movie, of course, is the chemistry between Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore.
Absolutely. And, honestly, I know I have not seen Blended, so I don't know about that one. But I've seen 50 First Dates, and it's just... It's not there. Like, yeah. A lot of people, they're trying to recapture the chemistry, but I think so much of the chemistry in The Wedding Singer has to do with how the movie puts them together with this good chemistry, but then also they have good chemistry.
Yeah, I can somewhat agree with that, because I certainly think that 50 First Dates is not as good as The Wedding Singer, and it's certainly not as rewatchable.
Right.
It's one of those movies that when I do watch it, I like it. I think that it's a really... funny and pretty well done film, but I felt like the real magic of Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore is in The Wedding Singer. This is like how a couple, like a new getting together couple in a romantic comedy, should be portrayed. Like, if they don't have this level of chemistry, it's not going to be anywhere near as believable. So that really is, I think, the best part of the film, is just how well they play off of each other. So, I think that kind of brings us to an end on this discussion of Wedding Singer. I think we're both of the same mind that this was a tremendous rewatch.
Absolutely. And definitely holds up. I will say, what's your favorite song? I'm going to give you three specific questions.
Okay.
Favorite song where they play the original recording of the song, favorite song that was covered by a character, and then favorite original song in this movie, which one is one too. But.
Ah, that is, man, that is tough.
And I'm going to say in the movie, not like just the, your favorite song in general.
But yeah, the one in the movie. Yeah. Okay.
The way that it's used in the movie.
I want to say, Do You Believe in Love, from Huey Lewis and the News was,
that was, yeah.
Was well placed in the film.
It was in the DeLorean scene?
Yes.
It yep. was, because I'm looking at where it is on my list of songs when it came out.
Yeah, it's after that. After it's the Hangover bit, I think, or it's somewhere. It's played in a shot that's outside of Julia's house.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. You're
right. Let's see. Cover song. Probably "Love Stinks," which was originally done by
so
J. Gillis Band, and is performed by Adam Sandler, and is freaking hilarious. Original song, this is tough because there are two original songs that Adam Sandler performs in this movie that are great, and we've already like heaped a bunch of praise onto Grow Old With You, which was is a beautiful song, but I gotta say, man, Somebody Kill Me has me just inside, my sides are splitting, I am in pain laughing every it's time so, he performs that. So
I love that song. It is so much fun.
So those would be my picks, I think.
Awesome. I'm gonna give you my picks, but first I do want to tell a quick personal anecdote about Somebody Kill Me. So I mentioned being, you know, a teenager when I saw, like a young teenager. I was like 14 when I saw this movie.
Yeah.
Which is when it came out. We were watching it at my aunt and uncle's house. It was like, so me and my cousins had already watched it the night before. My aunt and uncle rented it. The next night it was me and my cousins again, and then my aunt and uncle and my dad. And so we get to the Somebody Kill Me scene, and all of us kids were just like, oh, yeah, this is the really funny part. And then he starts like, oh, it all was bullshit. And the parents are all laughing, and everybody's going, but then suddenly it gets to, I hope you fucking choke. And then all the parents just stop laughing. They're like, no, that's terrible. And then my cousin's like, no, no, that's hilarious.
Oh, I dropped an F-bomb in there. Oh,
right. Can't do that anymore. But, yeah, so my three. For original recordings, based on the way it's used in the movie, Love My Way, which is actually right before Do You Believe in Love.
Yep.
But then it's actually used twice. I didn't realize it till last night, but it's used again in the bar when Sammy's giving his speech about wanting someone to hold him. Mm. So that's on there. My favorite cover is gonna sound weird. It's when what would have been Robbie's Wedding when the string quartet is playing Don't Stop Believing.
That was my second choice.
Is it? Yeah.
Yes, I'm with you on that because I actually love that string rendition of it.
Yeah, and then as much as I love Somebody Kill Me, my favorite original is still Grow Old With You.
And that's
but I do want to give a shout-out in the covers to the Nat King Cole one, That's All, that he's singing in the bar mitzvah scene during the butt grab scene.
Oh, yeah, that is wow, that is a good call. That's a just tremendous performance from Sandler. And, of course, we all know that, you know, Ladies' Night from John Lovitz is really the one that steals the whole show, but we've already heaped so much praise on that, it was just unfair to keep it going.
Yeah, it's the bigger kid that you don't let play football with all of the kids.
It's, and originally performed by Kool and the Gang. So, yes. Tremendous. Go out and get, like I tell people, go out, watch this movie, but definitely go get the soundtrack too. I don't think you'll be disappointed. There's not a bad bit on it.
Yeah. And if you want to hear the Broadway version, you know, it is on Spotify.
Oh, sweet.
Or if you could find, because it's not playing in sort of professional theater anymore, but there, I'm sure that you can find a local production at some point in the next few years, because the ones based on movies are real popular to do.
So. Sure. And this movie was incredibly popular. It made $123.3 million worldwide, in its theatrical run off of a budget of $18 million. So you think about 1998, this movie was a huge hit. So,
and I know that there's inflation and stuff to consider, but you know, and not that I saw Glass, but
supposedly it's not in as many locations as this is, but this was made for $2 million cheaper.
Yes, and well, I saw a glass and never mind.
Yeah.
Surprisingly enough, though, the critic score on Rotten Tomatoes for The Wedding Singer is only a 68%.
Is it? I guess for some reason I thought it was 100, but I'm probably thinking of something else.
Yeah, I would think that – I think this movie deserves higher than that. I think that that's – I think that's lowballing.
I think so. And it could also be a situation where, you know, people went in, they saw Sandler, and they prejudged it whether they were trying to or not. I don't know.
Yeah. That's
maybe people that actually lived, like, that were adults in the 80s were like, well, that's not what the 80s was like. And yeah, it's like, well, the point isn't to be a historical representation of the 80s. It's just using it as a setting.
Yeah,
like, exactly. We know that JR didn't get shot in the summer of 1985.
Yeah, precisely. Like, it's not, it ain't exactly meant to be a historical, like, a historically accurate period piece. It's just meant to use it as the aesthetic because it's funny. It's a good joke, and it's a joke that holds up so well. And I would say this movie gets better with age. So, Wedding Singer gonna go down as an all time 1990s classic.
That's right. So, let's try and get this episode up before Valentine's Day, then.
Yeah, we are definitely gonna be doing that. I think. But
so for Valentine's Day this year, you and your sweetheart watch The Wedding Singer. If you don't have a sweetheart, have a bunch of your other single friends over and host a singles Valentine's Day, but not a Love Stinks party, because that is really stupid.
Yes.
Just have, like, your single friends over for a Valentine's Day party. Watch The Wedding Singer. Eat some heart-shaped cookies.
Do that. Or, you know what? Get a cake. Get a wedding cake.
Get a wedding cake. That's expensive.
It can be. But you can get, like, a single
layer. Or we had donuts in my way.
Yeah, and I will say this, folks. I never thought that gluten-free donuts would be good, but damn it, they were. They were quite good. I would have more of that. But before we go, if you guys want to give us your thoughts on The Wedding Singer, if we missed something, if you had a special memory of the film, share it with us. I am on Twitter at Russell_Sellers, and Sam is?
I am on Twitter at Mr. Woodles. I'm also on Instagram at Mr. Woodles, but it's pictures of my animals and food. And don't add me on Facebook, because I won't accept.
Yes, we don't do that. But yeah, you can hit us up on Twitter. Check out all the other great shows on Place to Be Nation Pop. There's plenty there for everybody. Lots of movies, music, sports, comics, more, all just discussed for you guys. And you'll hear all about all of those shows in the ad that's going to come up at the end of the show. Make sure you stick around for that. And speaking of sticking around, we are going to be back next month for a look at a 90s film that Sam and I have both never seen.
We want to keep it a surprise?
You know, I'm of two minds about it. Like, I kind of do it, I kind of don't, but at the same time, you know what? I'll let you make that judgment call. You want to keep that a surprise?
I'd say let's keep, since there's no vote, let's keep it a surprise.
Okay, folks, just come back next month, because it's going to be I guess we can hint them at what it is. It's a 90s classic.
It is a 90s classic, something neither of us have seen, and something where, well, that's led by women, because we've realized we have not had any films led by women yet.
It is, and it's won by a director who's directed movies that I think we both love.
Awesome.
So that's,
I didn't actually look up the director, but I'm pretty sure that that's the case.
Yep, I won't say the director name, because that'll give it away.
All right,
but
cool.
That is coming up next month. I think you guys are going to really enjoy that episode. I'm looking forward to watching it, because it's a true 90s classic, one that was very popular.
It's one that you it's so inundated, like pop culture, so inundated with it. I don't know how to, like, I don't know if I can go into it blind. Like, I don't know if I'm going to, I'm worried I'm not going to appreciate it enough, because I know so many things about it already.
Yeah. I'm looking at it as a, I guess we can say that like one genre it fits into is a buddy film.
Okay. That works. Gets away. That's okay.
Man, I hope not. I hope it doesn't give it completely away, but that's the movie. That's the genre that I think of it as. And that's why I'm looking forward to it, 'cause I love those type of movies. So, folks, come back in the month of March to check that episode out. Hope you've enjoyed this one. Hope you guys are either had or having a great Valentine's Day. Watch The Wedding Singer. holds up incredibly well. One of the best rom-coms of all time, whether you are single or in a relationship. So with that, thanks for joining us on 90 to Nothing. We will see you next time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Kimball here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post-Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlaceBeNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceBeNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.